Session number 6191, reel 2.
Did the Crossbow Committee meet in the war room?
No, I don't think so. As far as I remember, they met upstairs. No, I can't remember meeting down there at all.
Did you actually take minutes at its meetings?
No, I think at certain meetings, the ones I've mentioned where the prof met the scientists, that wasn't the Crossbow Committee, it was formed. Crossbow Committee, I think I'm right in saying, was formed after the first ones came. And, of course, there are conflicting views as to whether it was a sensible arrangement anyway. It cut across all the other... I think all the intelligence people would say it was a ridiculous thing they did to bring all these scientists who weren't accustomed to looking at evidence at all and who were very ill-informed and ill-advised. Anyway, I don't think they met him down there at all. I don't know where they met. I didn't take their minutes.
Wasn't there a great fashion for having ad hoc committees to deal with particular questions?
Well, they did. They did to some extent, but as far as one could, one channeled them into one of the existing things. I can't remember that there were a great many ad hoc. The PM rather liked them. I mean, he had things like the Tank Parliament and the Battle of the Atlantic Committee and the things of that kind, which lasted for perhaps might be 6 months or less or more. But I think we generally tried to channel these things into either the Defence Committee or staff conferences, which went in with the Chiefs of Staff minutes.
What were your main duties?
Me? Well, it's rather hard to say. But in the early part of the war, I used to take my turn at Chiefs of Staff meetings. I had been secretary since I joined of the thing called the Overseas Defence Committee. And there was a thing called the Home Defence Committee and the Joint Defence Committee who dealt with anti-aircraft and coast defence at home and abroad. And I used to come and look after them. And then when Churchill became Prime Minister, he assumed the title of Minister of Defence. And we doubled the part of Cabinet Office and Office of the Minister of Defence. And I started and ran a registry of the PM's military telegrams and minutes. And so I looked after that. And then I was responsible, of course, for getting the replies to his minutes. The military ones, the civil ones, went off to the civil side of the office. And I was generally the secretary of the Defence Committee supply, but one used to, and one went to the War Cabinet sometimes, but one used to move from one thing to another as work dictated, and it was just as easy to take me to take the minutes of Defence Committee operations as would be for Hollis. I mean, we were box and cocks, if you do anything right. Well, then, as the war went on, I tended to go less and less to the Chiefs of Staff and the Vice Chiefs, which were run by Hollis and his two... He had two men who did that, George Price and Tubby Earle, the airman. And I tended to get more and more drawn into matters which affected the military and the civil sides of the government, particularly the two particular ones where the Foreign Office and the Ministry of Production. And I became secretary of the Joint War Production Staff of the Munitions Assignment Board, which was partly in London, partly in Washington. And then I became, as time went on, more and more concerned with the post-war developments, and used to work a lot with the Foreign Office over that, and I went off eventually to the San Francisco conference as a military man on the delegation, and except that I used to go with Winston when he travelled, as often as not. We used to play box and cox then, either Hollis and or Ismay went and I stayed behind, or I went and I and Ismay went, or I and Hollis went. We did a pretty good box and cox affair.
So it was a matter of flexible rostering?
Flexible rostering.
How many of you were there running the Office of the Minister of Defence?
Well, there was Ismay, who was his chief staff officer. There was Hollis, who started as a lieutenant colonel and as a major general. He was the senior of the, and he sort of organised the office procedure and generally the running of everything and getting replacement staff and that sort of thing. And then there was me. And Hollis, as I said, had two people doing the chiefs of staff under him. I had two people. We were talking about what?
About the personnel in the Office of the Minister of
Defence. Yes, I had two people under me. One who dealt with the Munitions Assignment Board and all that sort of Ministry of Production side, and one who helped me in general, rather. But the great thing about our office was that there was no hierarchy, and really all the serious work was done by three or four people who did their own devilling and work, got on with it, and had access to everybody from the Prime Minister downwards.
So liaison was an informal business.
It was marvellous. And Ismay was a superb boss. And, I mean, if I put I put things up to the Prime Minister, or Hollis put them up, or he did. I mean, he didn't insist on it going through him, although he naturally wanted to be kept aware of what was going on. It worked. I can't imagine anything better.
Did you have formal meetings of the staff of the Office of the Minister of Defence, or did you simply meet ad hoc?
Never. He would occasionally go and have a chat with General Ismay or Joe Hollis or something, or the establishment officer would come and have a talk. That's all. We never had any formal meetings.
Did Ismay and Hollis live and work under the slab, or did they also
work? No, they worked on the second floor.
They're on the second floor.
We were all in a row along there.
If I can now talk about the preparations of other war rooms and citadels, did you have anything to do with the creation of the citadel at Dollis Hill?
No, I didn't know there was. I've forgotten that there was one. I may have known at the time. I had nothing whatever to do with it.
Did you ever hear anything about why it was not occupied or used by the Cabinet?
I think the fact of the matter is that remember that all the bad bombing of London by aircraft took place at night, and therefore everything in the day went on more or less the same. There was no point in moving, and we had places to meet in underground for night meetings if one wanted them, and I think each ministry had its own funk hole at the bottom. I certainly remember going to the Home Security one on some occasion. And it was no point in uprooting ourselves and putting ourselves somewhere else when the threat wasn't big enough. Now, we might have thought about it when the flying bombs started, but I think we got then so acclimatized to the war in general and for carrying on I mean, we might have had more meetings down below in that period than we would have before then. But there was never any point in moving away.
So the idea of evacuation wasn't seriously considered in 1944?
Not after the Blitz. I think, and I don't think it was considered during the Blitz either. I think we reckoned we could carry on. And of course, as soon as the last two big raids, which were two of the biggest that there were, in April and May of 41, the thing then stopped, you see, because they went off to Russia. There was bombing of sorts going on everywhere, and they switched from London earlier than that, I think, to some of the provincial cities at the same time. But there was never any question of our moving out.
I understand Mr. Churchill enjoyed watching air raids.
Yes, he used to pop up on the roof if there was something particular going on. Not that he would necessarily stay there very long, but he was quite impervious to fear of any kind.
Did he have a special observation post?
No, I think he just went up on the roof of George Street.
Did you ever go up there with him?
Not with him, no.
But on other occasions?
I forget, I think I did go up there once, but generally speaking, no. I was busy with my own business. I didn't know when he went up, you see, because he went off from his flat or from somewhere, and I was working in my office probably, or at a meeting. So I don't know when he went. And maybe if it was a night blitz, I was probably in Knightsbridge. I was certainly there for that big one in May, when Pont Street Church was burnt to the ground. But I don't think I did go up. I used to go up on the roof of my block of flats in Knightsbridge, which is fairly high, to look and see what was going on. I saw that enormous fire in the city of London, and things of that sort.
When did you actually move out of the war rooms?
Move out of them.
When did they close down?
I really don't know. I certainly don't remember meeting there once the war was over. I think probably before that too. The nap room went on, of course, till the end. But as soon as the war came to an end, it all packed up.
And what happened to the Cabinet Office? Did it stay in Great George Street?
Yes. It did for a time. Certainly, I was there for a year more. I was there till June 46. And certainly we didn't move at all in that period. We were busy writing the white paper on defence. But after that, I'm not sure. I was called back by Winston in 52. '52, when he got back into power. And I was for 6 months back. But we had moved round the corner into the offices which in our day had been used by the CNC Home Forces and his little outfit, facing the park. And we were all along that corridor. And who was in our old offices, I can't remember, but presumably somebody moved in there.
But as far as you know, it all stopped working after the defeat of Japan.
Oh, yes, from down below. Can't imagine why anybody would go on down there. I don't know. Of course, it is possible that people like the Joint Planning Staff and Joint Intelligence, who had a lot of stuff probably around there, and they may have gone on sometime. I don't know.
Where were your own records kept at that time?
Well, there was a lot in... there were a lot in my office and in the office next door. And I've no doubt there were a lot of central records which I didn't know about, which were filed from the office. But the registry of the PM stuff was all next door. on the first floor of George Street. And on the other side of my office, for the last certainly 2 years, perhaps three, there was a room managed by Joan Bright, Mrs. Astley, as she now is, which was a room where all the top military files were kept up to date, so that any commander-in-chief who was visiting London could pop in there and bring himself up to date about the other theatres. That went on all the time.
Was it used a lot?
Oh, yes, quite a lot. But you see, particularly by those who had come home for consultation or home for a visit or something of that sort, and some of the sailors and airmen and people, oh yes, they used to pop in there a good deal. And she used to conduct quite a correspondence with some of them. But her files, which are really very good and highly up-to-date files, are all there now, and I think they've just been all gone through again. And they are probably as good files as you'd find anywhere for this purpose.
Was that briefing centre also used by foreign senior officers, Americans, for instance, in 1941, 42?
I don't remember that. You'd have to ask Joan. She'll tell you.
Do you remember having any dealings with senior French officers in 1940?
No, I had nothing to do with the French. I never even saw De Gaulle. Even when he came to Casablanca, I didn't think I saw him. And I, no, the Free French were all dealt with by some totally different organisation, not by us at all.
It says in the archives that there was a visit by two senior French officers in January 1940. Did you see them while they were in the building?
Do you remember their names?
General Lelong was one
of
them.
Oh, Lelong, he was the military attaché. He'd been there quite a long time, I think.
I think he visited the joint planners.
Very likely, because of course we were... There had been staff conversations with the French, in which I did take part, in the spring of 39. And Lelong was the Frenchman, and an able young man called de Brandt, who also acted as interpreter. They were the two I remember.
Is there any other important feature of the cabinet war rooms which you think ought to be recorded?
I can't think of any. The fact of the matter is that we were able to conduct ourselves all through the war perfectly normally. That enormous building, which after all must cover several acres, never got hit by a bomb. Not the Foreign Office or the India Office or the Ministry of Home Security or the Cabinet Office. Nothing ever hit us, although we presumably were in the centre of the target. But no, we never got hit. So that we didn't suffer any damage. The only time I had any damage in my office was when the little Blitz came along in February, when was it, 44, I think. A stick of bombs fell over Pall Mall way. I know one of them fell just outside my club. And when I went, I was there, and I was on my way back to my office. I got to my office to find one window pane cracked. And that's the only damage we suffered the whole war. So, you see, there was no urge to do anything. Life carried on very well. Of course, some of the staff had a very difficult time. My own stenographer, Wendy Wallace, who was with me most nearly the whole war, she lived in Carshalton. And she used to sleep under the piano. And she had some hairy journeys to London by train. But of course, all through the Pathang bomb period, Carshalton to London was more or less on the route. But she survived and going strong still, I'm glad to say. But And there was the splendid old messenger who came in one morning. He was a lift attendant, he was. And General Ismay, who was very good with these men, he said, "Well, how'd you get on last night?" He said, "Oh, we had a bad night last night. We had a bomb fell. It got my mother. Well, did it hurt her? Blew her bloody head off." So, however, he didn't prevent him coming to work just the same. But we were a small, very closely knit and informal office with no protocol and all that sort of nonsense, and I think highly efficient in consequence.
And the general principle was business as usual.
Business as usual.
Thank you very much.